You're listening to Opera Box Score.
Let's get ready to rumble!
Wherever you are, however you're listening, it's America's talk radio show about opera. It's Opera Box Score. I'm George Cedarquist, joined by Oliver Camacho, Weston Williams, and Ashley Hardgrave. All right, this week, it's the East and West regions of the Best School of Music bracket. Who will join IU and UNT in the Final Four? Then we go inside the huddle with baritone Reginald Smith Jr. The 2021 Cardiff Singer of the World contestant is just wrapping up his MVP season at Lyric Opera of Chicago as star of Terence Blanchard's Champion and Amonostro in Aida. Will his thumb on the scale for the University of Kentucky affect the judges for the bracket? Plus, in the two-minute drill, voice majors feel seen by Beyonce.
So true.
Make sure you subscribe to the podcast, Spotify, click follow, Apple Podcasts, hit the plus sign, send us that voice memo or email us your hot takes, mailbag, operaboxscore.com, or just record your thoughts. Use that You Got Something to Say tab on the website. operaboxscore.com. Hey, look, however you contribute, you're going to get the OBS beer coaster, OBS lapel pin, and the number one OBS fan foam finger just for sharing your own hot take. Oliver Camacho on the show this week. Great to have you.
Grigor Dimitrov, the aging Bulgarian hottie, took out Carlos Alcaraz in the semifinals of Miami Open. I was shocked. I watched that match live, and I was truly devastated. But then Dimitrov was taken out comprehensively by Jannik Sinner, the Italian, in the finals. And with that win, Jannik Sinner is now our world number two. Everybody, he's number two.
Weston Williams, you're my number two.
Oh, thank you, George. I really appreciate that. I took my OBS foam finger once again to my wife's weekly dodgeball tournament. And let me just, I'm telling this to all of our listeners out there who are on the fence about getting these bits of merch. You should bring it because that brought them luck. They wiped the floor against the two teams they went up against, and it was all because of the finger.
Ashley Hardgrave, I'm glad you're here.
Yes, but honey, why are we even here when the Super Bowl of women's basketball is happening right now as we record? Listeners, by the time you hear this, we will know the results, but imagine our anticipation, because we don't yet know the future. But right now, in the NCAA women's playoffs, LSU and Iowa are squaring off, the Angel Reese and Caitlin Clark of it all. They are currently, the Hawkeyes of Iowa are leading 69-58 at the end of the third. And in mere moments, UConn and USC are going to determine the other spot in the women's Final Four, which, by the way, tickets for the women's Final Four this year have sold six times as many as for the men. I rest my case.
You know what doesn't sell a lot of tickets every year is the Frozen Four. Where are all the college hockey fans in this country? Michigan, my Wolverines, make it into the Frozen Four for the third time in a year. One of these days when it's in Chicago, I'm going to go to that darn thing. I cannot wait. I also can't wait to talk some opera.
Chalk Talk on Opera Box Score.
It's March Madness Part 2. We are over to the East and West regions. We're going to get straight down to it. And the first matchup, oh, it's actually me against Weston. Oliver is going to be the judge for this episode of the show. Matt Cummings, a little under the weather tonight, the judge last week. And because I'm the lower seed, actually, if it's okay with you, Oliver, I'd like to go first here with my team, and then I'll let Weston respond. The number four seed in the East is the New England Conservatory of Music, founded in 1867, and one of its early presidents, composer Amy Beach.
Wow. Oh.
Later on in its history, as we got into the late 20th century, the dream was to make NEC a top school in its field, like, say, MIT or Harvard, and a lot of the hiring really reflects that. Jane Eaglin, famous Wagnerian on the faculty, along with director Josh Major. Alumni including Marian Anderson, although that was just a honorary degree. So there you have it, the New England Conservatory of Music.
I am going up against New England Conservatory of Music, and I have been assigned Juilliard. So
heard of it?
If I look at my list of reasons to pick Juilliard, I just have written down it's Juilliard. It's Juilliard. And, you know, at the end of the day, Oliver, I think when you're picking which one's going to win this one, I think you might have to go with Juilliard.
Well, I'm so glad you put it that way, because there's nothing I detest more than hubris. And for me, it was going to be an easy decision in the first place because of how great New England Conservatory's voice program is. Their director of vocal pedagogy is none other than Dr. Ian Howell. And those of you who have studied with Ian Howell, you know what I'm talking about. This guy will scope you. He will check your fundamentals. He'll do those things where he like, he'll figure out your voice and you will know your instrument. And I love the facility over there. And you know me, I've got my Baroque prejudice. And I feel like New England Conservatory has historically been more Baroque, even though Juilliard has the 415 program. I feel like it's right there in Boston. So they edge Juilliard, which I think still only offers Baroque-ness to its string players and not to their singers. So
tragic.
Sorry, Juilliard.
How the mighty have fallen.
That's gonna go
maybe
to
I should have done more research.
That is amazing. Barf. That is an absolute upset. I just can't believe I'm seeing those headlines correctly. The New England Conservatory of Music. Wow. Moving on then to the other two teams in the East, the 2 seed Curtis in Philadelphia and the 3 seed out of New Haven, Connecticut, Yale.
I'm cracking my knuckles. We're going to go higher seed first. Here on this one. It is very interesting that these two are against each other when it comes to tuition benefits for their students. We'll get into that in a moment. Let's talk a little bit about the Curtis Institute of Music, otherwise known as If You Get In Here, You Go. It was founded in 1924 as a private conservatory to train professional musicians. Since 1928, the Institute has not charged any tuition. It provides full scholarships to every admitted student. It broadcasts itself as America's most selective conservatory. And selective it is. Not only do they provide full scholarship, there are only 153 students listed per Wikipedia at Curtis Institute of Music right now. Longevity, let's talk about it. She's got more than a century under her belt. She's got no signs of stopping. And honestly, any sort of free music school out there, she's going to be all right. There are always going to be people wanting to come to her. The legacy of Curtis is about taking away the noise of learning and education and just learning about the art. There's a quote from the founder, Mary Louise Curtis Bach. They shall learn to think and express their thoughts against a background of quiet culture with the stimulus of personal contact with artist teachers who represent the highest and finest in their art. So the aim is for quality of work rather than quick, showy results. Alumni, again, how much time you got? If we're talking about some older ones, people like Samuel Barber, Leonard Bernstein, Giancarlo Minotti, Anna Mofo, people that are a little bit newer, Juan Diego Flores, Amanda Majeski, Brandon Sinell, Jonathan Beyer, faculty, again, how much time you got? We got Julia Faulkner, Trish McCaffrey, Sherry Overholt, Eric Owens, Delora, separate faculty for diction in each of the different separate languages, Carol Vaness. When we think about the reputation of Curtis, this is where you go if you get in and you are ready for a career. This is not a place where you think about maybe possibly majoring in music. This is where you go when you mean business. And that's Curtis in Philly.
I have some things in Yale's favor. First and foremost, we have the Ivy League sort of reputation bump just kind of as a default. Around 200 students in the music program. I couldn't find numbers for the opera program specifically, but it's pretty small. The music department was created in 1889 and the school was officially established in 1894. So it's been around for a while. And because of that, there is a lot of really cool former faculty and alumni in there. I think that the legacy of the school is definitely a little composer forward. There's also there's actually a musical instrument museum, which we shouldn't overlook because, you know, Oliver, period instruments are an important part of historically informed performance. So
you are such a sucker. This is ridiculous.
Come on, keep it going. Keep it going.
In terms of alumni, we've got a lot of really cool composers. Like I said before, we got Missy Mazzoli, Caroline Shaw, Christopher Cerrone, Kevin Putz. We've also got some singers. We've got Matthew Polizzani is a big name, Christopher Maghiera, Jonna Beatty. In terms of faculty, they have some interesting past faculty. I really like looking at the lists of faculty for these old music schools that have been around for forever, because you have people like Horatio Parker, who was a dean back in the early 20th century. Paul Hindemith was on the faculty, as was Richard Cross, John Adams, you know, of my one true love. And also Penderecki also was on the faculty. In terms of current faculty, we got David Lang on there, who I believe has done an opera. I'm not entirely sure he's going to, I'm sure at some point. William Boughton, Jonna Beatty again, Gerald Martin Moore, and more. There are a lot of, like, you know, maybe not like the biggest names you've ever heard of, but like established, secure names that can give you a good musical education. As far as reputation goes, it got a $100 million grant back in 2005. So we have another free tuition sort of situation, and it's about in line with Curtis as far as selectivity goes. So maybe not quite as much of a gap as you might initially suppose between these two institutions.
But with none of the baggage of having to be an Ivy League student. You're in gritty Philadelphia. You're with the people.
This was also very easy for me, even before I heard either argument. But both of your arguments sort of affirmed what my decision was going to be. I have a personal experience with Yale. Oh, I have spent really? Time in New Haven, yes. I was a three-time finalist for their Vox Tet. So Yale to me is a four-letter word. I'm sorry.
And I think there might be some bias in this in the judges.
There certainly is. But what I do know is that people who go to Curtis are serious musicians. They are there to be musicians. People that go to Yale are going there because of the prestige of the name. And yes, Yale has produced plenty of outstanding alumni, but people are attracted to Yale because it's Yale. And it happens to have a well-funded and, you know, excellent music program. But when you really think about it, people go to Curtis because they're serious about their careers as singers or whatever. Nobody else knows what Curtis is, even. Like, you know, you can't drop Curtis as like a name of someplace you went to that people, you know, all over the world understand. Only musicians truly respect what it means to have gone to Curtis. And also, it's Philadelphia, way more fun than New Haven.
That's fair. So I'll give you that one.
The win is going to Curtis.
I mean, as a Yale Bulldog myself, that breaks my heart to hear you cast such aspersions on Mother Yale. But nobody wants to hear me wax poetic about the days of Bula Bula.
Drink.
We'll move on to the West region then. The number one seed, San Francisco Conservatory, which I'm backing against number four seed Denver. I'm going to go first on this one. Ooh. San Francisco Conservatory, founded in 1917, and among its administrators includes probably Switzerland's most famous composer, Ernst Bloch.
That's true. Sure. I'm more of an Altmar Schirk man myself.
Well, of course you are. alums include Deborah Voigt and Suzanne Menser, who's also on the faculty, along with Lester Lynch and Matt Worth, legendary baritones. And hey, this is what I really like about San Francisco Conservatory is that it recently announced partnerships with three different talent agencies that are in classical music as a pipeline to help its students move from the minor leagues into the majors. I think that's super unique. I think it's super practical. And it's what I would expect from a number one seed school like SF Conservatory.
Okay, listen.
What school is it going up against?
Oh, we'll get there. Okay. I know I'm going to miss some things. I don't know how I am still so tired, but I am so tired. But I applaud all of you for sticking through this, my colleagues especially. I am here to represent the Lamont School of Music at the University of Denver, otherwise known as Oh, who's that over there? It was founded in 1924 by a renowned voice teacher, Florence Lawant Hinman. It merged with the University of Denver in 1941. It's a little bit bigger than some of the selective schools we've talked about. It's got 300 music majors. However, it has a 7-to-1 student-to-faculty ratio. Them's good odds, kids. When we look at longevity, you know, she's kind of the new kid on the block who might suffer from that, like, up-and-coming label that a lot of smaller music schools will really, you know, they'll say up and coming is a good thing, and then all of a sudden it's not. So even though this place has been around for more than half a century, it still might get labeled by some people as an up and coming music school. When we talk about things that are really in its favor, the Robert and Judy Newman Center for the Performing Arts is an exceptional state-of-the-art facility. She is very pretty. It's got a grand opera hall, 2 recitals, a theater, technically tight practice rooms and spaces. It's a gorgeous, gorgeous building. As far as alumni go, there are a lot of people that have this place on their list, but in terms of the ones that they really tout, there's Hao Zheng Tan, the bass, who is listed as the only Chinese singer who has appeared at the Metropolitan Opera for 20 years in 26 operas, and then Robert Yakovich, who is a composer and former dean at Rice Sheppard School of Music. When we look at the faculty, you've got people like Catherine Cash, Matthew Plank, Heidi Melton. They've got 5 decades of experience between them. Sahar Nouri is the music director for Lamont Opera Theater. Students get to work on diction with Beth Nielsen, who also does a lot of stuff in both classical but chamber music theater, the whole thing. Reputation. University of Denver, she's not always in the big leagues, in, you know, with your Yales and your NECs, but it is a select private school in a city that is a little bit off the beaten path for professional musicians, even though there are major organizations like Opera Colorado, Colorado Symphony there. So that's why she's kind of a diamond in the rough. Yes, I did that pun because of the mining reputation in Colorado. Still, it is on the list of a lot of solid music recruits. And to be able to breathe at all at that elevation and make those sounds, it's not for the weak, kids. It's for the hardy.
That's true.
So don't overlook Denver as a city. Don't overlook Lamont School of Music.
Well, I appreciate your argument very much, Ashley. But what we're trying to do here for the Opera Box Score audience is help them make a decision about where they might want to go to school.
This is a practical segment.
And I think San Francisco, with their alliance with Ascanus Halt and Opus 3 Artists and the record label Pentatone, they understand that this is a business after all. And you're going to get yourself in front of those management companies. You might end up with a bit part on the next recording of La Traviata. There are many reasons to be in San Francisco besides being at the conservatory. San Francisco is a beautiful city. It's gay.
It's terribly fair. now we know. I'm
going to give this one to San Francisco. Congratulations.
The personal bias in this
good
ref
game. Good game.
To the final pairing in the West region, this is number 2, University of Southern California, which I am backing against number 3 seed, right across town. This is, this is going to be nasty. UC LA, which is Weston. You want to go first? You want me to go first? I'll let you.
I'll go ahead and go. I feel pretty confident in this one. This is the UCLA Herb Alpert School of Music, or if you're American, Herb Alpert School of Music. So in terms of longevity, this is not one of those schools that's been around for 1,000 years. You know, it's had music education in some form going back to 1919, but it didn't really have a fully fledged music program until about 1960. And then the school itself dates back to 2014. So music has always been in sort of the orbit of UCLA. Some pretty great alumni here. We've got countertenor Brian Asawa, Angel Blue, Joshua Guerrero, Marilyn Horn, friend of the show, Jake Heggie. And then they have some film composers as well. James Horner, who did actually write an opera one time. I don't know if it was any good, but, you know, he did write one. John Williams of the Star Wars, you know, went here. And John freaking Cage, who is just someone just for me. In terms of faculty, there's a lot of really interesting faculty through the years. Again, like a lot of these, longer lived institutions, maybe not as many really huge names that really stand out, but they still have some pretty heavy hitters. They've got Rachel Danielpour, who's a composer, Vladimir Chernov, Terrence Blanchard teaches here, actually. Ooh. It's a good department within this public research university, but it also added a music industry bachelor's last fall, which makes it a really good choice for all of you business-minded artists out there. And speaking as someone who did not go to a very business-minded arts program, you need the business to succeed in this industry. So that's actually fantastic. And if you're into film at all, if you want to step outside the opera world, I'll forgive you. Obviously, great film scoring department. You know, John Williams, James Horner kind of speaks for itself. So this is a pretty fantastic school of music that I think is going to stand up pretty well against their neighbors down the block.
Well, I'm going to help you out, Weston, as well. One more famous alum that we can't, of course, forget. James Dara went to UCLA.
Oh, yeah.
Keep those checks coming, Jimmy. Skit. Look at him.
If he loses, he's going to stop sending checks.
Look at him go. Look at him go. We're just so proud. So USC, here's the first thing about so great about USC is their cheerleaders have the most adorable outfits you have ever seen. These are like white cable knit sweaters that turn into skirts. They're a single piece with the gorgeous like SC logo on the front. I will say in football, I'm not a huge fan of USC, also known as the University of Spoiled Children, as my father, a Los Angelino, would say. But oh my gosh, those cheerleaders, just the costumes are so great.
Starting off really strong, George, do you have anything else you want to talk about the music program specifically?
Nothing than just wanting to go back maybe 130 years or so before your school was founded. Ooh. USC dates from 1884. Count it. It's a big deal around World War II when a lot of composers were fleeing from Europe and ending up in places like USC. Famous alumni including baritone Richard Bernstein, Marilyn Horn, Michael Tilson Thomas, and just in general, a really strong choral program. Faculty including Morten Lauridsen, my dear friend Ken Kazan, leading the opera program, as well as the likes of Ted Hearn. And get this, their show that they did this past November, they did Cherubin by Massenet. Nobody ever does Cherubin.
That's a pretty deep cut.
It's a pretty deep cut, right? I'm impressed by that. And I think USC is going to take UCLA in this round.
This one is a real toss-up. I don't feel like either one is that strong of a contender.
Dang.
I do. Rough. I know. I mean, the alumni on both sides are very impressive. But I think I was going to give the edge to UCLA, her Upper School of Music, because of their business programs, their idea of entrepreneurship. But the fact that you could do a show with Ken Kazan at USC, to me, is a selling point.
Yeah,
I think he is an incredible stage director. I don't know how much longer he's got, how many more years he's got left in him. But I think the opportunity to be in a show directed by Ken Kazan gives USC the edge. I'm sorry.
Well, and I'm glad you asked, Oliver, because as a boy, I was directed by Ken, and I was a marvelous.
Do you want to change your vote, Oliver? It's not too late.
All right. So USC takes it in a close one. We're going to hop back to the East and get somebody into the Final Four. Oliver, you've heard the drills already. It's number 4 New England Conservatory Music against the number 2 seed Curtis. Someone's got to go on to the Final Four. Who's it going to be?
Make your choice.
I love Boston. I love Philly. Gosh, Boston sports. Maybe that's going to be the...
Oh, wow.
I don't know. I mean, like...
Who can afford to go to sports balls when you got to pay tuition at NEC? You know where you don't have to do that? Eagles games in Philly.
Okay. You're right. This is for the students. So if you can get into Curtis, you got to go to Curtis.
Boom. Okay, there we go. Right. Curtis into the Final Four. That makes a lot of sense, actually. So let's hop down to the West again. Number 1 seed, San Francisco Conservatory of Music, against number 2 USC. who moves on?
Wow. I didn't think it would come down to this, but I think it's going to have to go to San Francisco just because they are buying their students with access to management.
Yeah, exactly. So that gives us the School of Music Final Four, which we're going to wrap up next week. In the South, the University of North Texas. In the Midwest, Indiana University. In the East, Curtis. And in the West, San Francisco Conservatory of Music.
What a this final
is like,
four.
This is collision course material. Let us know what we're missing. We're going to wrap things up on this segment until next week. operaboxscore@gmail.com or even mailbag@operaboxscore.com. That's a better place to write to us. Let us know what you're thinking. And of course, make sure you subscribe to the podcast. Spotify, click follow. Apple Podcasts, just hit the plus sign.
Huddle up. Let's go inside the huddle.
Reginald Smith Jr. is in Chicago wrapping up his performances as Amanazro in the Francesca Zambello, friend of the show, production of Aida. You might remember that name as he was the representative of the U.S. in the 2021 BBC Cardiff Singer of the World. And he's a singer who he's always been in my orbit. And finally, I got to see him in Tosca at Santa Fe last summer. And it seems that I can't go to an opera these days without hearing Reginald Smith Jr. sing. Before we dive into this interview, let's listen back to his performance of Wolfram's aria, O Du Mein Holder Abendstern from Tannhäuser, from the 2021 BBC Cardiff Singer of the World. The Welsh National Opera Orchestra is conducted by a friend of the show, Michael Christie. Reginald Smith Jr., welcome to Opera Box Score. I must have heard you in other things before I realized who you were, but I was at Santa Fe Opera, I guess in 2022, was that? In 2023. And you were singing Scarpia in Tosca, and I suddenly realized, oh, this is the same guy who's coming to Chicago to sing Amanazro in Aida. And then all of a sudden, you were announced as the replacement for Eric Owens, who dropped out of Champion as the older Emile Griffith. And suddenly, I was just immersed in Reginald Smith Jr. content. And it feels like you are on kind of a series of debuts. I know that, you know, the pandemic sort of interrupted that, but you were in the famous Porgy and Bess revival of 2019, you went on to sing Don Alfonso in San Diego, which feels a little bit like of an older role for somebody who's as fresh sounding as you, but I'm sure there was some concept there. You were also singing Uncle Paul in the Chicago presentation of Fire Shut Up in My Bones. So that's been a lot, right? Like it just in the past few years, it's just been kind of snowballing, huh?
Well, you know, I will say it's very interesting because I've been doing the thing for quite a while. I guess other people have just decided to notice over the past few years.
Sorry.
And I'm okay with that, too. I've been here. Actually, the first thing I did at Lyric Opera of Chicago was Fellow Travelers, which was even before the pandemic.
Yeah. Oh, is that how you met Marcus Shields?
Yes, okay. Actually.
Yeah, I saw that.
And Marcus went to CCM, which was just up the road from the University of Kentucky. So we already had lots of friends in common anyway. But yeah, so it's been very interesting to go back to the Così Fan Tutte, singing Don Alfonso. You know, there's nothing in the score that says that he has to be old. Mm-hmm. It just says that he's older.
Yeah.
Now, in our modern conceptions, we've always made Don Alfonso like a retirement role. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that's necessarily accurate. You know, I like to think of it as, think of, say, you have these kids that are 21, 22, 23 years old and they're like, oh my God, I love my girlfriend. I just got out of college, bro. Oh my God. And you have somebody who's like 35 that's like, look, that ain't gonna last, you know? And they're like, yeah, whatever, pop, you know, Gen Z, you know, it's, I feel like it's closer to that relation as opposed to like Grandpa Alfonso talking to like a 25-year-old. But anyway, there's nothing in the libretto to say that that would suggest that he's much older. But anyway, that's my moment.
We can talk about that opera a lot. We're not going to, but because I can talk about it forever because I really, really love this opera. But I've always been sort of angry with Don Alfonso because he's just so cynical and he's dragging this libretto out of the Enlightenment. He's trying so hard to make it a modern libretto, a modern story, but it's still written by Mozart and Da Ponte. And there is like this goal to show the audience, no, we're still here in the 18th century. We still believe in the good in people, you know? But Don Alfonso wants so
Don
badly.
Don Alfonso's like, nah, bruh. But, you know, anyway, it's very interesting. But I will say, over the years, I've had the great pleasure of doing a wide variety of roles, from singing Germont in Traviata, which I've done several times, Sharpless in Butterfly. I've sung Colline in Bohème twice, which was ridiculous. And I've sung Marcello in Bohème, which I'm doing again. Completely different spectrums of the voice. I've had the great pleasure of doing new works like Castor and Patience at Cincinnati Opera, which was catered for my voice, and doing things like Fire Shut Up in My Bones and Champion, while also still doing things like Notte di Figaro and Italian Girl in Algiers and lots of Aida and all of those things. So I've considered my career truly a blessing. And in addition to doing lots of the operatic works, I do a lot of concert work, a lot of things with just orchestra in the traditional choral orchestra setting, like Beethoven Nines and Elijah and all of those things. Also lots of Christmas pops and those things, which is completely different, and lots of very interesting and varied recitals. So I consider myself a vocalist that is, you know, I'm blessed and fortunate that I can do a lot of different things with my voice. And just, you know, I guess people finally start to take notice after a while. I'm okay with that too.
Well, there's a whole other topic that we're, because of those things that you listed, we should maybe just touch on. Why do you characterize yourself as a baritone and not a bass baritone?
Because I'm not a bass baritone. That's the easiest answer to that.
Okay.
You have to think about what is the characterization and the classification of the voices. One of the main things is range and tessitura. Mm-hmm. Just because one has the notes does not mean that it is comfortable for one to sit in that part of the voice. Okay. So, and oftentimes in today's standard, when we think of baritones, we only think of one type of baritone. Mm-hmm. It's the American problem, if you ask me. We think of the lyric, lighter baritone, or you go into dramatic land. And if you look at the cavalier baritone Fach, mm-hmm. which you find in the German systems, or even closer to sort of a spinto baritone, you find a lot of this repertoire that in America, we either put too many light voices trying to do it, mm-hmm. or we put too many low voices trying to do it and push up. And when you find those voices that actually fit right in that fuller, more dramatic baritone voice part, we don't know what to do with it here in America. I also have the great privilege of being a wonderful, beautiful Black man, which means that my voice has a lot of color and it has a lot of range. So I can sing down to like a low F and I can sing up to a high A. I don't want to sit up there singing Largo a Factotum. I certainly can't sing any of the Zarastro stuff. But my voice likes to sit right in that concentrated middle, which is where you find roles like Falstaff, where you find roles like Sharpless. You find roles like Amenazro, Iago in Otello, Scarpia in Tosca. And again, oftentimes we now associate those roles with older singers or bass baritones fantastically, like Sam Raimi, who made some of those things popular, or Jim Morris, you know, who made those things popular, but it's not really their voice. If you were to ask them, they would say, you know, that middle top was always a little bit of a stretch. So when you find these baritones of that bravura quality, we often sort of get misconstrued for other things. But that's okay. I always tell people I put it in my voice, and if I can sing it, I sing it. You can call it whatever you want to call it. Just give me the check.
Okay, well, I'll leave that there. I mean, there's a lot of conversation that we could have there about...
You could have as much of it as
well,
you want.
I have other topics I want to talk to you about, but I mean, you're the one who characterized your own voice based on your race, which I'm okay with because I agree with you, but that that can open up a can of worms for people who are not Black, well, you know? Like, if I were to say that, it's like, oh... You know, his voice has that depth and that color because of his race. You know, I totally agree with you, but if I were to say it, I'd be in hot water, you know?
Well, I will say that we all have different qualities of our voices. And part of it is based on where we were born mm-hmm. and the region in which we were born. It's also based on our genetic makeup. And the structure of our bones. And, you know, one of the things that I love so much about a lot of my Asian colleagues, especially, you know, the ones from Korea and China, one, they have such beautiful high bone structure, mm-hmm. which is great for resonating. You have all of that bone that you can vibrate sound off of, but also just how the language is placed. The sound is always right and high in the mask. So a lot of times with a lot of the Asian singers, you don't have to work as much about getting them to sing in the mask. You have to worry about getting them to open up the sound. For instance, from someone like myself, I'm from Atlanta, Georgia, and all of my family is from Georgia. And if I were to speak in a good Southern accent like I was raised, it gets real Southern like this and I start to swallow my tongue. Mm-hmm. And then, so I've had to work a lot over the years of getting the sound out of the back of the throat and getting it up into the mask resonators. And that's just part of the region and the dialect and language that I was raised with. And so we all have these different qualities and characteristics. But I will say the majority of the time with African-American voices, no matter what voice type it is, there's usually a bit of extra warmth, even if it's someone like Kathleen Battle. There's still that beautiful warmth in that soubrette color to her voice yeah. that is just very appealing and very distinct. That has nothing to do with racism or anything.
No. I'm not accusing you of it.
I will throw it out there so people know. But I find it interesting that. And you can use all of those beautiful nuances mm-hmm. and colors and God-given things to create interesting colors. Just, you know.
Yeah. Well, I just want to drop a name in here. Jeanine Dubeek, who, you know, is making her career doing 18th century music. But we know that there is some sound in there. Like, just listen to that woman sing. And now she's singing Micaela already, you know. So, okay. Yeah. But
beautiful, beautiful voice and beautiful person.
So I'm going to pivot here right now because I think you've actually introduced a path for me to get to this topic. I don't know you. I just met you. And I already came to the table thinking of you as this person who is interested in the artistic presentation. But here you are so far all we've talked about has been like technique and Falk and stuff like that. So I know we are allowed to contain multitudes, but I have to say that your Emile Griffith here in Chicago was so moving. And I think everybody who saw it felt very emotional because of what you were doing physically. And it felt like a very detailed and prepared performance. And I did want to ask you about preparing Emile Griffith and how you're a young man, you know, how you went for these, you know, physical tics that I think a lot of people who take care of their older parents, whatnot, they recognize like, yep, that's what it's like, you know. Can you talk about how you prepared yourself for that?
Yeah, thank you first for the wonderful compliment. I really appreciate it. Emile is a role that I've actually wanted to do for a while. I was in the original production of Champion in St. Louis when I was a young artist. I was man in bar in the corner, not even the one that gets to sing the duet, you know. Yeah. But I've always loved Terrence's music, and I've always been drawn to the story. And what was amazing at the time, Arthur Woodley was phenomenal, simply one of the best singers and one of the best people. And I was fortunate that when I made my Met debut doing Porgy, I got to share a dressing room with him, with Arthur, who looked a lot like Emile Griffith as well. And to watch Arthur craft this role as a young artist was really a lesson of artistry. But also at the time, Emile Griffith was still alive. And Arthur and Jim and Terrence Blanchard, they actually went to visit Emile Griffith. And so to hear these stories kind of up close really helped to inform when I had the opportunity to do the role. Of course, I found out with less than a month before the first rehearsal, because, you know, a wonderful colleague had to back out for personal reasons. And I was blessed and fortunate that they asked me to do it. So I already had a sense of how I wanted to do the role whenever I had the opportunity from observing Arthur and those interactions. But I did really try to read into the libretto and try to think, what have I observed personally dealing with people with memory loss in my own family? And observing the small thing, like one of the things that my great aunt had dementia, and she was always the lady that was very well dressed, and she wouldn't go to the grocery store if she didn't have high heels on. I mean, she was that lady, you know. And as she started to lose her memory, and her children would say, "Mom, I think you need to go and check on this. You don't need to tell me what to do. I know what it is." You know, how she would immediately get really offensive, really defensive, sorry, and then would kind of calm down. And I thought about that as Emile is singing, one shoe, two feet, one shoe is missing. Where's my shoe? And he has this moment where he's panicking. And how can I bring that not only musically into what I do, but how can I bring that into what I do physically and characteristics? So a lot of times I would actually look in the mirror and sing these things to myself and say, does it look like what I'm singing? You know, just here in this apartment. And okay, if I'm going to hold my arm a certain way, is it consistent? If I'm going to walk, what is the walk of an older person like? You know, what would it feel like to suddenly come alive again? And then to have to go back into this state of being. So I really tried to focus on incorporating all of that into the character while allowing the libretto and the music to influence the character as well.
Well, I really wish that we would have had this interview while you were still doing that, because it was very powerful stuff. And I know the people around me in the audience were just as moved by it. In our remaining minutes, right now on Opera Box Score, we are going through our own Sweet 16 bracket of undergraduate programs for voice degrees. And I know that education has been very important in your life, and you have a strong relationship with your alma mater. What can you tell the audience, especially the young singers listening, who might still be choosing where they're going to go, and what programs or courses you took that have been the most beneficial in your career?
Well, let me say that those that know me very well know that I always wanted to be an educator. If you ask me all the way back to like fifth and sixth grade, I always said I wanted to be a teacher. So my goal was to be a high school choir teacher, basta così. I love singing. I was fortunate I went to a school for the arts, and I started taking lessons and got introduced to opera. And I never thought of myself as having a full-time singing operatic career. I always loved singing, and I thought if I did more singing, that I would have more to give to my students. So you asked me earlier about education and if that's something that comes around. I do a lot of teaching currently. I do a lot of master classes. And yes, education will always be the biggest part of my life. Even, you know, teaching people about music and getting them excited is really what I love doing. For me, when I was getting ready to go to undergraduate, I was fortunate that I had counselors and teachers that gave us a grid of really important things. Where is the school? How big is the school? How far away from home is it? You know, how big is the music program? What is the city like? Is it a big city or a small city? You know, the things that we don't think about outside of, you know, the academic courses that help make a difference. Because if you're stuck in a place for 4 years that you really hate, then it definitely taints your experience musically and academically as well. So those are things I would say to really pay attention to. You know, if you don't want to be 12,000 miles away from home, that's something you should consider. But for me, as a music education major, kindergarten through 12th grade, in addition to vocal performance, I think the most important thing that you can do is be as well-rounded as you can possibly be. While I was at the University of Kentucky, I, for a semester, was a part of the UK Dance Ensemble. I did three shows with the UK Theater Department. I did opera chorus. I did the undergraduate operas. I did the graduate operas. I worked with the children's chorus. I had my own little children's choir at church, where I was conducting and directing them. I did solo stuff. I did Cincinnati Opera Chorus. You know, I wanted to learn. I was an assistant for the opera director for a semester just to observe and follow. I sat in on different voice lessons and voice studio classes just to see how the different teachers taught the same material and how they got the point across. I think what you have to remember is that there's not an undergraduate opera degree. The degree is an undergraduate voice degree in music. And at the end of the day, you have to think of how can I make a living in music and also be happy? So with your degree, with those things, think of what can I do with this degree that will make me happy? And will this place give me those opportunities to spread my wings, to learn about business, to learn about jazz and musical theater or choral music or sacred music, or to, you know, go and play for the football team? I mean, there's so many amazing opportunities and things that you can do. So for me, I think getting a well-rounded education is the most beneficial thing that you can do for yourself. And that does not have to be at a large university. It does not have to be at a conservatory. It doesn't have to be at a small school. It just has to be the right fit for you. I don't know how helpful that is to anyone, but that's my
advice. I think it's extremely helpful. I think that, you know, I look back to when I was, 17, 18, making those decisions, and I was just falling in love with the art itself. And I just wanted to be submerged in it. I wanted to be around people who were doing it. I just wanted to sing, you know? And all of the things, all of the things you talked about just now, it's like, what? What? That you have to take those into the consideration too, you know? And I was lucky that I got accepted into my first choice. I didn't even, you know, didn't even think about other things, you know?
Well, I mean, I told myself that I wanted to get as far away from the South as possible. And I applied to Boston University and Butler University and Indianapolis and, you know, New England Conservatory and the Manus School in New York and at the University of Kentucky, which was the closest to home. Mm-hmm. And I thought to myself, you know, if something were to happen or if I needed to get home quickly, how fast could I get home if something happened or if there was a family emergency? And during the time that I was in college, both of my grandparents passed away. And I was fortunate that between Lexington and Atlanta, it's only a 45-minute, 50-minute flight. And so when I got the call about my grandmother passing away, well, as she was dying, I got the call that morning. I was on a flight that afternoon, and I was back in Atlanta by like 4 p.m. there. And that's something that I'm very grateful for now, that I didn't think would be, you know, it's just one of those things you don't obviously plan for and imagine and hope for, but family is very important to me. So being able to get back to my family very quickly actually proved to be something very important for me through undergrad. Plus, I will say I was fortunate that I went to the University of Kentucky, where there's like 35,000 kids. And so the music program is very specialized. But if I just wanted to take college algebra and be last name Smith number 45 in a room of 250 kids, great. Who cares? No one knows me. I could just disappear on campus for a little bit. You know, so I appreciated having a specialized small music program. And also being able to just go to a basketball game and chill out, you know. So that was for me. So I think you have to find your place and what makes you very happy.
Il concetto vi dissi, or ascoltate come gli è svolto. Andiamo, incominciamo.
Another performance from the BBC Cardiff Singer of the World competition in 2021. The prologue from Pagliacci, sung by our guest Reginald Smith Jr. with the Welsh National Opera Orchestra, conducted by Michael Christie. Thanks to Primo Artists for putting us in touch with Reggie.
This just in, the 2-minute drill.
All right, listen up. Here's everything you need to know about what happened in Opera Land this week.
In the most important news of the week, Beyoncé's new song, Daughter, off Cowboy Carter, contains a performance of Caro Mio Ben. Yes, that Caro Mio Ben. Queen Bey put a little spice on the classic aria with period inaccurate ornamentations and an unexpected minor mode to give the piece more pathos. No word on whether or not she intends to include the other 23 Italian arias and songs on future albums.
Detroit-based Opera Moto has debuted their directory of gender-diverse classical music professionals to coincide with the Trans Day of Visibility, which was yesterday, March 31st. The directory aims to provide opera companies, symphony orchestras, and other arts organizations with a direct list of qualified individuals to consider for roles and positions, as well as increase visibility and placemaking for the trans community, which is underrepresented and historically excluded from the opera and classical music fields. Trans and non-binary musicians can join the directory through Opera Moto's website.
Mere days after he was appointed the new director of Maggio Musicale Fiorentino, Carlo Fortes may face prison time over the accidental death of a cleaner who fell from a ladder while working at the Rome Opera in 2017. The court sentenced Fortes to 16 months in prison and imposed a 22,000 euro fine for what they say is a violation of occupational safety regulations. Fortes' lawyer says they would appeal the decision and blame the cleaner's death on a high blood alcohol level.
Welsh National Opera is facing the latest consequences of the great defunding from Arts Council England. Beginning April 2025, management at the company plans to reduce the salaries of orchestra players. Quote, it will be unsustainable for our members to weather such a hit by falling back to salaries they were on 5 years ago, said the musicians' union. Quote, this is yet another UK opera company having to contemplate their orchestra moving to part-time employment. Stable, secure jobs in the profession are simply dying out.
Facing criticism for cutting programs and the implementation of cost-saving measures, San Francisco Symphony has released a statement in the wake of artistic director Esa-Pekka Salonen's resignation. It reads, for many years, the symphony expenses have exceeded its revenue, and in recent years, that gap has been growing. Without immediate action or extraordinary new funding, we anticipate that our cumulative cash losses could grow by an additional $80 million over the next 5 years, far beyond any means of funding such losses.
The 2024 St. Louis Theatre Circle Award honorees include friend of the show Janae Brugger for her performance in the title role of Susanna at Opera Theatre of St. Louis. Her outstanding achievement in opera was a critical contribution to last summer's production, which was also honored as an outstanding production of an opera. See what being a friend of the show can do for your company? Come on, Bavarian State Opera, send us some media comps.
Jonathan Tettelman and Pretty Yende are the co-winners of the Minetti Schrem Opera Prize, which includes a $10,000 professional development grant for each singer, as well as, get this, the opportunity to perform at the Minetti Schrem Opera Program at Festival Napa Valley this summer. Outreach for those underserved Napa Valley audiences. Didn't see that one coming.
On the disabled list, the Paris Opera halted a performance of Simone Boccanegra and sent audiences home without completing the show when soprano Nicole Carr fell ill. Carr took to social media to alleviate concerns for her fans, saying, quote, after a night in hospital, I'm feeling better and hope to be back on stage again very soon. Well, we wish her well, but what about all those people who don't know what happens to Amelia and her dad, Simone? I mean, that plot is complicated enough even if you get through the whole opera.
True.
Exit stage right. French conductor and pianist Jean-Pierre Mathy has died at the age of 91. Mathy initially intended to be a full-time concert pianist before muscular problems shifted his focus to conducting in the 1950s. He recorded a number of operas, including a performance of Poulenc's Dialogues of the Carmelites with Régine Crespin, as well as pieces by Offenbach and Rossini.
And on this day, April 1st, happy April Fools, everyone, it was the first performance of Handel's oratorio, George, Judas Maccabeus, at the Covent Garden in London. That was in 1747. Domenico Cimarosa's Amor Rende Sagace premiered on this day in 1793 in Vienna. In 1866, it was the birth of composer and pianist and love of my life, Ferruccio Busoni. In 1873, Russian composer and pianist Sergei Rachmaninoff was born. In 1892, Chilean baritenor Renato Zanelli was born in Valparaiso. In 1907, it was the birth of composer Walter Kaufmann. In 1913, Manuel de Falla's La Vita Breve had its premiere in Nice. And in 1937, Giancarlo Menotti's opera Amelia Goes to the Ball had its first performance in Philadelphia. And to cap it all off, Aaron Copland's opera The Tenderland had its premiere in New York City on this day in 1954.
And that is your two-minute drill.
Once I thought I'd never grow tall as this fence. Time dragged heavy and slow. But April came and August went before I knew just what they meant.
Just the opening phrases from an aria that every soprano learns in college. Laurie's song from Aaron Copland's A Tenderland. We heard the iconic recording of Dawn Upshaw in her prime with the Orchestra of St. Luke's from that album, The World So Wide, which I think all of us from the 90s have.
90s kids will remember.
Yeah, exactly.
This is the third straight week that the San Francisco Symphony and Esa-Pekka Salonen have been doing this back and forth.
Well, this statement is really interesting because it's very long. The criticism of the San Francisco Symphony due to the fact that on paper, they seem to have a huge budget and the second largest endowment of any orchestra in the U.S. behind Boston. Those are huge numbers. And yet there is not just the fact that Esa-Pekka Salonen is leaving because they're cutting some of his favorite, you know, new music programs, which is part of it, but also the orchestra, the musicians union there has been, I think, for over a year now, working without a contract, that is, and they're all getting paid much less than they feel they should be for an orchestra of their size, which I don't doubt is the case. So it's kind of interesting that in light of Esa-Pekka leaving and the orchestra sending out a letter saying you should try to keep him, and all of these things happening, that the upper management felt pressured enough to send out this big document detailing we're really, really broke for realsies, you guys, is kind of interesting. The problem is I don't know enough about money. So I am begging any economically minded listener out there to please go through this whole statement and let us know, are these valid arguments they're making? Because I frankly don't know.
I assume we probably know more about Beyonce than we do about the San Francisco Symphony's financial statement.
Well, we certainly do this week. If you have been living under a rock, you might not know about this new album, Cowboy Carter, that came out on Good Friday. In addition to other religious things happening last weekend, people were very excited about this. And I think as people were listening to the album in its entirety, a little track pops up called Daughter. And in the middle of it, all of a sudden, for every voice major everywhere in every music school in the United States, you're like, what is this? It sounds familiar, but it doesn't quite sound familiar, but it does. And yes, it's one of the first art songs that every voice major learns, and it's Caro Mio Ben. But what I loved about it was that it was interpolated in the melody. They shifted things a little bit, but not too much, so that it fit into an A minor chord structure. And it was, yes, as we said in the opening script, voice majors everywhere felt seen, as did, you know, all of the other people who were excited about the cultural significance of the rest of the album of Cowboy Carter, which we don't have enough time for on this podcast to talk about.
Who knows how many people will come to opera through Beyonce. But, you know, I also have very nerdy friends, and somebody who is a scholar in historical performance, her post on my post on Facebook was like, too much vibrato.
How dare you?
Sorry, Beyonce.
Good call. Bad call on Opera Box Score.
Good call, bad call. Oliver Camacho, we're going to start with you.
Well, there's a story on the New York Times that's completely random. And I don't know how, you know, the arts editor said, yeah, I greenlight that. But I'm so glad that they did. It's a profile of a singer who has ties to Chicago, but is being celebrated in the New York Times for almost reaching 25 years as a ensemble singer at the Met. As of last Friday, he has sung 459 performances.
Oof.
And and he's just one of those people that, like, you know, he is in our industry. They do a job. He's got a great voice. He's actually a great musician, great sound. But, you know, he's doing these parts that are sort of like thinker's roles, like, you know, whatever, the sacristan in Tosca or whatever.
Yeah,
you know?
right.
And doing those types of parts, like those compromise roles, you end up working in the same city, you know, all the time, which isn't that the dream that we all wanted to, like,
that's
have, like,
absolutely
a career,
the dream.
Yeah, have a career in opera and you don't have to travel, and you get, you know, you get to be on stage for like 5 minutes and then you can just hang out in your dressing room.
It's great. Ashley Hardgrave.
Look, I could recommend the entire Cowboy Carter album to all of you, but you've heard enough about that on this show today. So I'm going to give you another recommendation, and that is the high camp, hysterical Palm Royale. You need to steal somebody's Apple TV login and start watching Palm Royale. You will burn through the episodes almost as fast as I did.
This is debatable as a good call or a bad call, but it is a listener mailbag. Kenny in Flint says, what happened? The University of Michigan School of Music thrown onto the scholarly dust heap of music by lowly CCM. They can't even make decent chili in Cincinnati. Kenny goes on to say, don't forget that Karlheinz Stockhausen came to Ann Arbor to work with the School of Music to record Samstag aus Licht. How's that for opera cred?
Yeah.
Kenny, the only person
more heartbroken
about that Wolverine loss than you is obviously me. And I tried to cook the books and even I failed. So from one Michigander to another, you know, the sign stealing, if we'd only had that, maybe we would have won that. That's it for this week's edition of America's Talk Radio Show about opera. Make sure you subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts, get your voice heard, and find links to stuff we've talked about at our website, operaboxscore.com. That's also where you can put your money where our mouths are. Give back to the OBS using the Support the Team tab. Your announcer is Norm Waddell. Your creative consultant is Oliver Camacho, and your audio editor is Weston Williams. For co-host Ashley Hardgrave and our guest, Reginald Smith Jr., I'm George Cedarquist, asking you to continue the conversation about opera as you race to your music bookshelf and figure out what aria can be sampled in your highly anticipated genre shift album. We're back with an all-new show next week when one school emerges as the Iowa Hawkeyes of voice diplomas. Plus, you get more opera headlines, more hot takes, and more opera in the neighborhoods of Napa Valley. Join us.